Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:20 on March 30th. With us are Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Culver, Representative Joseph, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. First item on the calendar today is House Bill 214, Repeal the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission. And carrying the bill is Laura Seidel from my office. We first heard this bill March 14th, and during the last hearing we adopted SES version E. Laura will give us a real brief recap of the bill.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Laura Steidoff, and I'm staff to Chairman Olson. Before you is the committee substitute for House Bill 214, Repeal the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, version P. As we discussed in this committee on March 14th, the repeal is by request of Commissioner Dragas of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. During the hearing on the 14th, Nancy Mead, General Counsel of the Court System, spoke about a few changes that they wanted made to the CS. These changes have been made and mostly include bringing back original language from the Workers' Compensation Act prior to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission establishment being established in 2005, as well as some transitional language on how the physical files will be transferred to the court system.
Well, this might be a great time to entertain a motion to adopt the blank CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move CSHB 214 version 29-LS0854/P is the working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. Now you can walk us through it.
Okay. So, Section 5, AS 2330, page 3, lines 6 through 31, and page 4, lines 1 through 11. We deleted all the material and inserted original language from the Workers' Comp Act, AS 2330-125, from 2004 prior to the establishment of the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission. And that was requested by the court system to return the power back to the Superior Court and keep the language clean. And Section 12...
Point of order, Mr. Chairman, that previous section you were describing...
Pardon me?
Can you state that location of that previous section, the first change?
Representative Culver, through the chair, Section 5.
Section 5.
2330 on version P.
Right. Lines, the whole Section 5?
Yes. We had deleted that and inserted original language from the Workers' Compensation Act. That was provided to us by Nancy Mead with the court system after we'd had meetings regarding this bill, and it was since the courts will be taking on these cases, they wanted it to be set in statute the way it was previously.
Okay, just to clarify, Mr. Chairman. So from line 6 on page 3, AS 23.30.126, review a board order, little a, continuing on the next page through little g, is that that section that was replaced from the previous code?
Representative Culver, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Section 12, transitional provisions, page 5, lines 24 through 26A. We deleted all the material after shall and inserted be transferred to the Superior Court in the Judicial District where the original claim was filed under AS 2210-20 and Rules 604B and 609, Alaska Rules of Appellate Procedure. And again, that was by request of the court system to have the files transferred into the judicial district where they were filed, and just so that was clear. Page 5, line 30, after June 1st, 2016, insert within 30 days after the date that the board decision becomes final. Page 6, lines 1 through 17, delete C and D, and we replaced that with new language, which was... And again, this was another request to the court system for this language to be inserted.
And we do have Nancy Mead in the room.
Yeah, Nancy Mead.
We'll bring up in a few minutes.
Okay, because that would be good if she could kind of walk us through those transitional provisions.
Yeah.
The only question I had, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if staff's, what is the time period that a party has to appeal after their decision is made? What's the appeal period that they have before they...
So, Representative Calvo, through the chair, on or after November 16th, a party seeking review may file an appeal or petition for review with the Supreme Court as the section read on the day before the effective date of this act. And as Section C and D, it goes over that, in Section 12.
Okay, maybe Nancy can clarify. I'm just looking for when the decision's made by the board and you want to appeal that to Superior Court, you have, what, 30 days? Is that?
It's, 30 days after the date that the board decision becomes final.
Thank you.
To the chair.
Representative Ledoux. No?
And Section 13, page 6, line 22. Removed February 20th, 2017, and insert December 31st, 2016. And that was just to have the commissioner's terms end at the end of 2016. And the Section 14 conditional effect, page 6, line 25, conditional effect, this act takes effect only if Sections 8 and 10 of this act receive the two-thirds majority vote of each House required by Article 4, Section 15. Constitution of the State of Alaska, so requiring a two-thirds vote, since there's court rule involved.
Representative Ledoux.
So is basically this exactly the same procedure that we had before we redid things in 2005?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, yes. And that was why this Section 5 was made it exactly as it was in 2004.
Thank you.
Deja vu.
Yes.
That it?
That's all I have.
Well, I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS as the working document? Seeing none, version P is the working document. Any questions for Laura?
Actually. I'm just curious. I just noticed that Section 15, the Act takes effect June 1st, and typically it's July 1st. Is there some reason why June 1st?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I don't have a clear answer for that. I'm sorry. Okay. But Nancy Mead may have an answer.
Any further questions before we bring Nancy Mead up? And apparently, Anna, do you want to come up with Nancy as well? Maybe one of you two. Thank you very much, Laura. Two lifelines. Please state your name and affiliations for the record.
Thank you for the record. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System.
Anna Latham, Legislative Liaison, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And Andrew Hemingway, the chair of the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission, is also available for questions.
I guess I would like to go on the record and thank the sponsor and the sponsor staff for being so responsive to the court system's requests. As the committee knows, this basically reverts the procedure back to where it was in 2005, and the court system thought it would be helpful to have almost the very same wording as existed in 2005, so that all the case precedents, et cetera, that were decided then could be applicable now, and it could streamline some of the case decision making and provide predictability for the litigants. And so that is mostly what happened with the Section 5 changes. The transitional provisions at the end were also put in to address our concerns that we wanted to ensure that the files that came over from the Department of Labor were in the form that appeals have to come to the Superior Court. So those were some wording adjustments that basically said you need to supply them in the format that the court needs them. And I think that was not problematic for anybody, and it will work fine for the court system. We can absorb these cases.
And I might add, this has not been an easy bill, and I really appreciate the help from the Department of Labor, the court system, and my staff as well. A lot of time was spent on getting everything to align. But does anybody know the answer on the date, or is that the June date?
Mr. Chairman, the date is correct as far as Section 15 on page 6. The effective date of the Act, we did request for it to be effective June 1st, 2016. This would give the Appeals Commission until November 1st to finalize and to wrap up those cases. So that was just a date that was chosen when we drafted it. We thought that was 5 months was adequate time for wrapping the cases up.
Any further questions for Representative Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either Anna or Nancy, so someone who felt aggrieved in some way from the board ruling, they would until November still file an appeal to the commission? Or does the language speak to their right to sort of demur or wait until the Superior Court would look at it?
Through the chair, I'll take that. Through the chair, Representative Josephson. The transition provisions are sort of staggered in. After June 1st, if somebody has an appeal, they would come to the Superior Court with that appeal. And we will need to begin accepting appeals from final decisions of the Workers' Compensation Board beginning June 1st. And then the current commission, anything it still has pending in November will then transfer to the court for finishing up. So it's staggered as to when the court will take jurisdiction of the cases. And then to address a question that arose earlier, I'd like to point out that in Section 5, on page 3, lines 6 through 10, and this was a question that arose from Representative Culver, that clarifies that it's 30 days is the time period before which a commission decision is not final. It becomes final on the 31st day is an easier way to say that, and then the appeal can be taken. And it also refers to the appellate rules, which says that you have 30 days after a decision becomes final, which is standard under the Administrative Procedures Act, I believe, for all administrative appeals to the Superior Court.
Thank you. So, through the chair, an appellant could continue to use the commission and might find disposition of the matter to his or her satisfaction, or might not during this window. I mean, the commission is going to continue to meet. So existing appeals, they will handle. I imagine their morale may not be all that high, but they'll handle them. Is that right?
To the chair, Representative Josephson, I'll let the Department of Labor address their morale, but yes, they will not be accepting new appeals after June 1st. Those appeals will come straight to the Superior Court, but they will be wrapping up any pending matters, and anything not wrapped up by November will then come over to the Superior Court. And under these provisions, they will come over in the appropriate format. That is, we have rules about pagination of the record, et cetera. So I think this addresses all the time periods in these several transition provisions.
Representative Culver.
Yeah, just trying to drill into the mechanics of the decision. So they refer to when the decision becomes final, 31 days after it is filed. So that filed indicates that would be a written order, not a decision oral from at the hearing, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, that's my understanding.
Okay.
We do issue written orders.
So I know this isn't probably, you know, because you're the courts and not the Workers' Comp Board, but so pending that 30, there's 31 days in before it becomes final. So I guess there's opportunity maybe if for a party to ask for a partial reconsideration of the board on a decision. Just maybe that's Department of Labor can answer that. So a written order is issued, and then it gives it opportunities for a party maybe to ask for partial reconsideration or something before they go through that final appeal and the order is final.
Representative Culver, through the chair, I would actually like to bring Marie Marks, the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, up to address that question.
Okay, thank you.
Come on up, Marie. And thanks for joining us today. Please read yourself onto the record.
Sure. For the record, my name is Marie Marks. I'm the director of the Workers' Compensation Division for the state of Alaska. And Representative Culver, to answer your question, a decision by the board is issued in a written format, and it's filed with the board and effective when it's signed by all parties and served on all parties. That starts a couple options for someone who would like the board to rethink their decision or have someone else look at their decision. They have 14 days to ask the board itself for the board itself to reconsider its decision. So that clock is ticking. They have 30 days to appeal their decision to a higher power. So those clocks move at the same time. If the board takes no action within that 14-day time period, the power to reconsider is gone. But they still have that power, that right to ask for appeal within that 30-day window. So as far as I understand, and I might get a lifeline from Andy Hemingway here on the appeal process, since he's more of an expert on taking those appeals from the board, that the draft as written, I think, would have to be inside that 30-day window, meaning if you don't reach that 30-day window by June 1st, you need to go ahead and seek appeal with the Superior Court. So it's June 1st, and you have to reach your 30-day window before June 1st. That's my understanding of the working draft. Did I answer your question, Representative Culver?
Kind of, but you brought up a new one. So,
new question?
Well, just to follow up on that one. So if a party asks for reconsideration within the 14-day period, then that would effectively stay the 30-day period for appeal pending action on the reconsideration, right?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, no, there is no stay. They are proceeding at the same time.
So they get a decision back within, let's just say, the 13th day. Hopefully they would have something back by the 29th day on their request to reconsider.
If the board... the board must take action on reconsideration within that 14-day period. So the board will let the parties know whether they are going to accept, for example, additional briefings, or they'll actually issue a decision on reconsideration. But more often than not, if the board will let the parties know whether reconsideration has been taken up or not. If no action is taken by the board within that window, that essentially is a denial of reconsideration. So the parties will know within that window for reconsideration whether the request has been granted or not.
Okay, and that won't change going forward. Just when, if you don't get a satisfaction with the Workers' Comp Board, you're appealing to the Superior Court going forward.
Correct.
Okay, so you 14-day, 30-day window at the board level, that process will remain constant, and you're just appealing to the Superior Court in your jurisdiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And every decision we issue has this language at the end of it informing all the parties of what their rights are. And they can ask for reconsideration. That will not change. That before and after, if this statute becomes effective, that won't change. They can ask for modification. And that's a different time frame. That's a year from the time of a decision. That won't change. It doesn't change the existing procedures. The only thing that has changed through this legislation that's proposed is that instead of appealing to the Appeals Commission, the appeal will go to the Superior Court as it did before 2005. The other avenues for having the board's decision reviewed, appealed, looked at, modified will remain in place. And timeframes of those venues, methods.
Berkman will do.
So I'm wondering, actually, how many cases do we have out there that kind of can get caught in this sort of limbo? Well, I mean, it's not really limbo between the the transitional, which may be there, and whether they're there or not depends upon whether the Appeals Commission actually decides the case before the effective date of when it needed to decide it.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I asked that very question to see what was going to be happening to the courts on November 2nd, possibly, and I was assured that it was, perhaps at the most a half dozen cases that would be left in limbo, as you put it, that would be still pending before the commission, but maybe not resolved yet. And they actually would expect it to be fewer than that if they continue with their work. So that is something, again, that the courts is willing to handle.
Paula?
So let's just assume, okay, so a case comes over that hasn't been resolved in the appeals or in the Workers' Compensation Appeals Court. So then do the parties have to do all the briefs all over again? I mean, just physically do them again? They don't get transferred because they're in the incorrect pagination?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the court system anticipates that there may be some delays inherent in this process. I don't think that they would have to rebrief everything or print the brief again with different headers and page numbers. The commission, under the other provisions of the transition sections, will have to provide everything in, again, the form that the court requires for any agency appeal. So I can see the commission doing the bait stamping, whatever it is, of the pages of the full record in a form that the court can use. And I anticipate that we'll be able to work with the Department of Labor to ensure that that goes smoothly. And there may be some delays. I wouldn't guarantee to parties or injured workers that there won't be, but we're hoping to minimize that.
Thank you.
Representative Colbert.
So just let me clarify that process, because there's been some changes over the last 10, 15 years. So do we still have a hearing officer that hears the initial request for workers' comp benefits or coverage, medical issues, and then a workers' comp board and Superior Court, or we not have the hearing officer anymore?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, a board decision is a result of a board panel, and every board panel consists of at least two members, but usually three. One chair person who is the attorney member, staff member,
right,
and one and member of labor and one member of industry.
Okay.
That's the first decision making.
Okay.
Stop on the train.
Okay, because the one, excuse me, yeah, Mr. Chairman, the one case, and it's been a number of years. I remember it was just a hearing officer, administrative law judge type, and we've done away with that with the previous reform.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, that must have been way before my time.
Okay. All right.
So, as it is now in statute, it's absolutely a panel, which,
okay,
is a quorum is a minimum of,
okay,
two, but usually three.
Now, my other experience was that there was half of the time was spent, I watched other cases, with attorneys representing the folks that had the claim or issue. They're arguing on their attorney fees. Do we have some schedule? How do we arrive at just fees in these cases? Is there some kind of schedule? Is there some kind of process on determining reasonable fees that would be paid to represent the appellant before, you know, the board, and then I guess in the Superior Court too?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, I'm speaking to the fees that are awarded at the board level,
yeah,
it has not changed, and there's a statute in place that provides for attorney's fees, and as long as certain requirements are met, generally it's actual attorney's fees, reasonable attorney's fees, is at the board level. On appeal, I go ahead and either have my lifeline, Andy Hemingway, or the court system expert speak on.
The bill in Section 5 has one provision on attorney's fees as applies to what will happen at the Superior Court level, and that's on page 4, lines 9 through 11, and that is the statutory guidance given to the courts for how to award attorney's fees. Generally on appeal, the court has provisions for attorney's fees that are not going to be the same as what the board had. At the board level, the person's entitled to full reasonable fees.
On the board level, generally, there are exceptions, but I'd say in most cases, they are full, actual, reasonable attorney's fees.
And for the record, this is Nancy Mead, since we're going back and forth, and I'm sorry about that. The one of the reasons the court system wanted the old wording of the Workers' Compensation Act in place is there was much litigation about attorney's fees mm-hmm. on workers' compensation cases at the Superior Court level, and those case decisions will still be effective. And so it is not something that's cut and dried or something that is set out in a grid or in a formula in statute.
Okay, well, thank you. And you referred to that little G section, line 9, that the court won't make a judgment to the injured worker to have to pay recover those attorney's fees for this appeal. That's kind of a protection for the worker in that section?
Through the chair, that's how I read that section, too.
Okay, and then generally...
Is this a new question or follow-up?
Well, the follow-up on these attorney's fees. So it's the insured that get hung with the taxes. I mean, not the taxes, but the attorney's fees. The insurance company, you're making a claim and contesting whether to say they didn't want to provide for that knee operation that they feel is necessary to get them back on their feet. And so we're before the Workers' Comp Board, and then, you know, attorney's fees are argued and fairly decided there, and then the insurance company, the workers' comp carrier, then would be liable to cover the injured workers' fees, right?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, and just to subsection G here, you know, applies to, it addresses fees on judicial review, so I'll speak to the one that your question on the board.
Right.
On the board, awards of fees, the board will award fees to be paid to the employee's attorney, full reasonable fees, and those for the issues upon which they prevail, and those fees are paid by the, is a compensation benefit. So the entity that pays compensation benefits would be responsible for them. If it's a self-insured employer, sure. It would be that self-insured employer.
Okay.
If it's an insurance company, it'd be the insurance
All right.
company.
The follow-up, but I wanted to ask maybe to, Mr. Hemingway, if he's online. That, Andy, are these, is there a lot of...
Andy, are you there?
Yes, I'm listening in.
Yeah, is
you
it...
Go through the chair.
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to Mr. Hemingway. Are these attorney's fees, is it fair, do they spend a lot of time arguing for their fees when they're hearing these cases? You know, back when we did it in these different fashions and then under the Workers' Comp Board, is that a problem or does it burn up a lot of time? Can you just kind of give us a broad brush analysis of what typically goes on and how big of an issue that is?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, I believe you asked about the nature of the issues that the commission has heard and our appeal to the Supreme Court, and I did take a look, and it was, let me see, where is that? I listed that as for the cases that are appealed from the commission to the Supreme Court, it's a fairly common but not the most common subject for litigation beyond the Appeals Commission. Our own experience here at the Appeals Commission is that it's not a major subject. In terms of the amount of fees, there's, like anything else, there's always a question about how the statutory provisions should be interpreted, and so there are issues that arise, but it's not usually over the amount per se. In other words, dollars and cents for the amount of work that you did. It's more to the point of what parts of the appeal did you prevail on and which parts did you not prevail on, because you're not going to recover for those issues on which you did not prevail, and there can be a little back and forth on that. So it's It's a subject, but it's by no means the most common thing.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So I just want to clarify something. When a case is before the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, do they get full attorney's fees or full reasonable attorney's fees?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes. It's the same, basically the same standards apply before the commission as apply before the board.
Follow-up? So when they're in front of the superior court, are they going to get full reasonable attorney's fees?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't know the answer to that, and I can look it up and get back to the committee.
And actually, the bill, when it moves, is going to judiciary. So.
I will have the answer then.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Culver.
Yeah, the reason I'm drilling into the attorney's fees is because the cases that I've witnessed on these claims, the attorneys spent more time arguing about their fees than looking out for their injured client. And I thought, you know, is this getting carried away? Is this, you know, something... of a problem area, you know, we're trying to help the injured worker, and so I just was curious to if we have an issue out there and how vague it is on determining these fees that creates this uncertainty that generates maybe issues. So I think we'll pitch that one up to the Judiciary Committee to thrash out. How about that?
See, I'll interject on that. I think that was one of the few things that didn't come up during all the work that went on this bill, and I think if it had been an issue, that it would have been brought up and it would have been kicked around and addressed. But, yeah, feel free to bring it up in Judiciary.
Yeah.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, Nancy, thank you for being here. You mentioned, and I maybe misheard you, I think you said that pretty much the language that is being reinserted in here was almost what it was pre-2005. So if it's not identical, what is different?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, Section A is, I actually am looking at the 2005 version compared to the version P. And this is something that, again, the sponsor's office and the Department of Labor had in front of us as we tried to come up with something that would work well for everyone. In the bill, Section 5, sub A is slightly different from what A looked like in 2005. And the kind of work group that looked into this thought that it was just clearer to have those provisions in the current bill. And they are just timelines that are clearer now in the bill than they were previously. And nobody thought that would present any problem. But in the bill, lines 11 through 31 on page 3 are exactly what was in the 2005 law, different subsection numbers because of a repealed section, but it's exactly the same text. And then on page 4 of the bill, lines 5 through 11 are two subsections that did not appear in the 2005 law, and those were in the original version of the of this bill, and something that the Department of Labor had wanted in there and didn't seem problematic, and also did not seem to the court at least that this would cause a lot of troubles. But again, that was wording and language that had been in the original bill that the Department of Labor was involved in. Does that answer your question, Representative Hughes?
Yes, very much. Follow-up. With a small follow-up. So in Section A, the timeline language is just, it's not changing the timeline, it's just clarifying it. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions for Department of Law, the Department of Labor, Workforce Development? Laura? Seeing none, thank you again, and I think I'll open up public testimony. Is there anybody in the room?
Something people are dying to talk about.
Seeing none, is there anybody online? We've got, this could be another one of those. We do have Ledge Audit online, but I think for a different bill. Nobody online? Again, nobody in the room cares to testify on this. We will close out public testimony. What are the wishes of the committee?
Move the bill.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move CSHB 214 version 29-LS0854/P from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition and hearing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee with as amended with attached fiscal notes, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill. The omnibus insurance bill. There have been a number of concerns that have been brought to the committee, and at this time we're working on a CS, and we'll be hearing the bill again when the CS comes up. So with that, the next item on the calendar is House Bill 281, Real Estate Broker Licensure Requirements. Terry Harvey is going to be presenting on behalf of Kathy Munoz. We just went through the omnibus insurance bill. It passed.
Yeah.
No.
I thought you were taking up the
we're waiting for CS.
Manicuring and the yoga bill.
No, they're coming back in later. I think Andy was here for that one. Terry Harvey is going to be carrying the bill for Representative Munoz. Got our undivided attentions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Terry Harvey, staff, Representative Munoz. We're going to veer off into real estate with this bill. And just for just a moment, at your discretion, a little bit of background. Historically, real estate was a business made up of small local individuals who financed properties through local bank relationships, raised equity with neighbors, maybe a local doctor or an attorney. However, over time, the business has become increasingly complex, and transactions today require the coordination of numerous documents, contracts, service orders, and handles a lot of different issues, foreclosure sales, short sales, trust accounts. We're addressing today, this bill will address education requirements and experience requirements that a licensee, if you will, in Alaska must have in place before they can apply for a broker's license. And there is one broker per real estate firm. And their duties include oversight of all monetary transactions, details of those transactions, fees involved, trust fund transactions, full responsibility of those deals, and they all fall to the broker. And this individual is ultimately responsible within that brokerage, and they're responsible for all the licensees that work under that broker and are associated there. This bill proposes to require additional educational credits and additional real estate experience to the current requirements that are in state law for real estate licensees and before they can qualify to become a real estate broker. The Alaska Real Estate Commission collaborated with the Alaska Real Estate Association. They discussed this several times at length in the past year. And so they brought this to the legislature, and the idea was to better serve consumers, to ensure high-quality transactions, to help avoid litigation. And what we believe we will accomplish with this legislation is to improve standards, improve the training, and bring Alaska closer to nationwide standards. The changes in the current existing statutes would be that a licensee, which is a real estate agent, if you will, or an associated broker, would be required to complete 30 hours of education, and currently it's at 15 hours. This would be before they could apply for the broker's license, and they would also be required through this legislation to have 48 months of experience rather than the 24-month current requirement. Licensees around the state have spoken in favor of these changes in the testimony to the Alaska Real Estate Commission, and we feel that this is a timely issue and a good way for those that wish to become a broker to better serve their those licensees under the brokerage and or the general public. So we sort of look at it as a consumer protection and a better way to serve the public. And you know, brokers today have much more to do than they ever have, and we feel that these education and experience increases will make for a much better possibility that the general public will be served in a better way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Terry? For Sam Colbert.
Yeah, the continuing education requirement, Terry. So the bill would increase that to 30 hours. Is that upon renewal, like a two-year license renewal cycle, obtained 30 hours?
Through the chair, Representative Colbert, that doesn't change the existing statutes or existing rules on continuing education. It just changes the education hours to apply for the broker license. And I would defer to the Commerce folks on what those requirements might be for the continuing education as when you renew. But this is only in effect for a first-time application for a broker.
Okay. Well, just follow up. I would like to know that, because that's generally the case with continuing education. The only thing, Mr. Chairman, on that issue that I think I have concerns about, because with continuing education requirements, there's not a lot of curriculum out there that's generated specifically for Alaska circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's not entirely very valuable just to make a requirement that thou shalt get continuing education, and you run out and get it right before your license is due online or whatever. But, you know, we might want to put something in that, you know, something specific to Alaska circumstances to make it more meaningful, that has some element to tie it locally rather than just generic. Could be on anything. Could be on weatherization. It could be on financial transactions. Or not required at all. I mean, it's kind of a business generator for those that provide those services to sell these packages to renew your license, because you get in the mail when your license is up 10 or 15 different postcards to renew your, get your education credits with this. It seems to be more of a business than necessarily related to the specific discipline. It improves the occupation, and it's more specifically towards Alaska. So where's that? This bill is just to us. Okay.
Well, it gets a little more complicated than that. The Senate got a jump start on us.
Okay.
And the we're going to be setting this bill aside, and the Senate bill will be over here shortly. So at that point in time, it will have the same committee.
Okay,
referrals. So
on that, maybe I'd ask through the chair to the sponsor, maybe to reach out to the real estate professionals and see how they would feel about, you know, kind of, you know, maybe you had 10 of those hours on some specific Alaskan area of, you know, because this law changes a lot. Foreclosure law, agency representation, you know, number of things that probably would be helpful for practitioners to get up to speed on. Just kind of thinking out loud here, if that's something that it might be of value.
I'm guessing there's at least one or two people in the room probably took notes on that. But with that, we will hold Representative Ledoux.
So whenever I see a bill which increases regulation on an industry, I mean, I often wonder what the necessity is for that. So this is going to make it so that in order to become a broker, you're going to have to increase the amount that you've worked, I guess, for a broker from 24 months, which is 2 years, to 48 months. And I understand the real estate folks are saying that this is going to increase public safety. But it's actually also going to be a benefit also to the people who are real estate brokers now, making it more difficult for other people to become real estate brokers. I can graduate from law school, and immediately upon graduation from law school, I mean, it took 3 years to graduate, but I can immediately open up my own law office. No supervision by any other attorney. I can immediately do that. And this is now, the way this is written, I think it's going to take 4 years of practice before somebody becomes a real estate broker. And so I guess I'm wondering, other than the general statement from the realtors about how this is going to be a great boon to public safety, I'm wondering what the problem was. I want some specific instances of where somebody screwed up because they didn't have 48 hours or 48 months of training rather than 24 months of training.
Representative Culber.
I like what you think. You know, when you're talking about licensing and professions, or any industry, there's generally some kind of effort to carve out some kind of protection for that industry. So let me give an example. If I were to try to be a licensed surveyor in Hawaii, I would have to apprentice under a Hawaiian surveyor and pass a test knowing some of the Hawaiian language, okay? It is designed to keep people from the mainland going over there and taking their jobs. So when we look at this kind of legislation, we have to be careful we're not carving out exclusionary business, you know, the businesses that make it more difficult for those others to compete with them, that we're creating an exception that, you know, creates more value because they're able to get a law passed to protect their industry. So I think we do need some backup on the record, Mr. Chairman, why this is necessary. I don't think you just go out and hang a shingle and become a broker. I don't think we have a total libertarian society that would be good. You know, we have these deals where we have dual agency representation. There's a lot of things about disclosure that's important. You know, what is the duty of an agent to disclose what different parties they represent, what problems they know of the property. There's a lot of legal responsibilities that go along with being a licensed real estate agent and the broker. But I think we do need to make sure that we're not just carving out an exception that we're going to make them more, you know, increase their business at the expense of the consumer without having something to back it up.
And what I can do is I can put the Senate sponsor of the bill on notice that that is going to be a topic of conversation when the bill hits. And we will get it resolved. I think there are probably a number of people in the room that have felt the same way, and I'm sitting here wondering why the nail techs have to get $200. And, Representative Hughes.
Yeah, and actually I was going to ask the same question before Representative Ledoux. What was an example of a problem? And I don't know if the sponsor staff has an example of a problem. I'm curious or if you want to wait.
I think I want to wait, and then we'll just have it all wrapped up into the you know, the final version. But and we'll give them adequate time to research it as well.
Okay.
Well, Conrad's making notes.
Follow up. It just got my curiosity up. So I'll be looking forward to understanding what the problem seemed to be.
Terry,
Mr. Chairman, we will have folks here available. We do have them available from the Real Estate Commission and from Commerce, and I believe that they can speak to some experiences that might further reiterate the reasoning here. Real estate industry has grown, continues to grow in Alaska every day, and as it grows, the responsibilities always rise up to the broker as the ultimate backstop to ensuring that all the statutes and the laws and the intricate details of these transactions are made right and held to the utmost standards. Alaska sometimes, and we're not here just to match standards down south on requirements, but there, I believe the Real Estate Commission has provided some materials that shows where we stand as far as our requirements in Alaska, and you'll see that we're down pretty, have the fewest amount of requirements to get that broker license, but that's not what we're here for, just to match the lower 48. We're here to get out in front of this, and I believe the commission will be able to show some examples of some situations that have been having that will shed some light on the need for this legislation.
Well, my consensus that the committee has got their curiosity tweaked, and with that, we do have Nancy Davis online, chair of the Alaska Real Estate Commission. Are you with us, Nancy?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Did you hear all those questions, or we'd like them repeated?
No, I heard them, and I would like to respond.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Correct. My name is Nancy Blatchley Davis, and I am the chair of the Alaska Real Estate Commission. And the Alaska Real Estate Commission is not the organization that brought this up. It was about 25 various licensees who came before one of our meetings to say that they felt like they had seen enough situations where a broker was not knowledgeable enough to protect the public. Alaska is in the very bottom. I think we're in the bottom four in the list of requirements to upgrade to associate broker or broker with all the rest of the 52 states, I'm sorry. And never was there a comment that we are trying to eliminate brokers or maintain a small amount of brokers. Everybody that spoke to this had to do with protecting the public. We see through the Alaska Real Estate Commission more and more cases that come through that could have been prevented, the public from being harmed, if they had had more education. And that's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to make anything difficult for additional people that want to upgrade to a broker. We just feel like the 15 units of education in 2 years is not sufficient. And I would tell you that when I was a licensee, after 2 years, I upgraded to a broker to own my own business. I really didn't know a whole lot, but I had a mentor that got me through it. And I think about those people that do upgrade that don't have mentors, then they're not supervising their licensees, and they're not making sure that things are done right and the disclosures are made and the public is protected. Any questions from me?
Representative Ledoux, Representative Culver, any questions?
Well, I guess I'm still looking for specific examples.
I don't know that I could give you an example off the top of my head. I live in Sitka, and I have not really seen any issues. I know there's more issues in the larger cities. I think we could probably put something together for you without using any names to show you exactly what some of the situations have been and get that back to you as a real estate commission.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, when someone is in the pendency of their brokerage examination or licensure, are they normally a real estate licensee making a living?
If they are, yes, if they are upgrading to an associate broker or broker. They have already been a licensee, and they've been working for 2 years.
All right. And follow up. This would make the minimum requirement 4 years working under.
To become you. Yes, you can become, you can take all your classes and you can pass a test and you can become a licensee. But the way it is right now, within 2 years, that licensee who has not had a lot of experience can upgrade to a broker, open their own business, be involved in making sure that the trust accounts are all accounted for, that the licensees are doing what they need to do, as way as, and far as disclosures and the, doing it the way the regs require. And the licensees that came before us felt like that was not sufficient time for a two-year licensee to open a business and try and conduct business and protect the public. But if you want examples of situations without any names, just here's some things that have happened, the Real Estate Commission can get that to you.
And
Representative Ledoux.
And when you're getting it to us, could you include the length of time that these people had worked at the time that these examples had happened?
Absolutely, we can do that.
Thank you.
I might add, we've got two people online from Legislative Audit, and we also have the head of Legislative Audit sitting in the room. And if I could ask Chris just to come up for a minute. I hate doing this to you on the spot, but I don't have a copy of the most recent audit on the real estate board, but was there anything related to what we're talking about as one of the things that was highlighted in the audit? Or
For the record, this is Chris Curtis with Legislative Audit. No, we did not identify, when we reviewed the activities of the commission itself, a specific need to change the requirements for licensees, and I don't think we identified that as any type of risk area. In conducting the sunset, we would have only come across that if it would have been in the meeting minutes, say, for a commission, and the commission hadn't responded to it. So we didn't see anything like that when we looked at minutes. It was not part of the audit.
Well, thank you. I hated to put you on the spot, but you were sitting there. And thanks again. Since we've opened it up to public testimony, Tracy Berrickman. Matt Sue, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tracy Berrickman. I'm representing myself as a licensee, as a real estate professional, and as an educator. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I have been licensed for over 23 years, approximately 16 years as a broker. As a result of that, I have reviewed and supervised thousands of transactions and hundreds of licensees over the years. I understand firsthand what they learn, teach, counsel, and advise their clients. I'm also a commissioner for the Alaska Real Estate Commission. I have been an educator for about 18 years in real estate. I also serve as a subject matter expert for Pearson View, which is our testing authority. I serve on the state level, and I'm the only one from Alaska that I know of that serves on the national level. This experience gives me insight as to what licensees are doing in the field and how they're conducting themselves as professionals and the way that they represent their clients. Real estate is not a buyer beware industry. Please understand those professionals are representing clients, many homeowners, and as we all know, for many Americans, their home is their largest investment. Addressing restraint of trade does not outweigh consumer protection. To become a broker in Alaska, you can obtain your broker's license with only 85 hours of education and 2 years experience. Most states, comparatively, most states require a minimum of 60 to 90 hours of education just to have a salesperson license. As an educator and commissioner, I have a duty to protect. I feel our duty is to protect the public and therefore, you know, support this legislation. I recently experienced firsthand dealing with two different brokers that had, and this just happened about 3 months ago, that had minimal education and insufficient experience to successfully resolve a dispute. Both of those brokers failed to understand simple contract law, and they lacked the experience to recognize errors that each had made, as well as basic problem-solving skills. This is why we're asking for more education. The clients of those brokers were faced with significant losses. One of them was representing the buyer that stood to lose over $10,000, and the other one, he was a first-time home buyer. The other one stood to lose a $600,000 contract. As an experienced broker, I still find myself facing challenges. I face challenges every single day. Cannot imagine being a brand new broker in today's climate with only 85 hours of education and 2 years of experience, not only for my own transactions, but in the position of supervising other licensees. An increase of 15 hours in education still leaves Alaska among the lowest in the nation for minimal education. Increasing the education and experience required to obtain a broker's license to protect our Alaskans is not unreasonable. Protecting their homes, their financial future, that's our responsibility as educators, commissioners, and legislators. Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you very much, Representative Culver.
Ms. Berrickman, this is Representative Culver. You're one of my constituents, right?
Yes, sir, I am.
Well, thank you for calling in and your service. So, Tracy, you're an expert and you teach real estate education. Would it be, is there a curriculum available if we were to look at requiring some Alaskan-based continuing education? Is there courses out there tailored towards that? Or, you know, maybe you could comment on that for me. If that's of some value, tied more to our regulations and specific circumstances within Alaska rather than just broad brush nationwide issues that we encounter.
This is Tracy Berrickman. Our curriculum for broker upgrade, a lot of it does cover quite a bit of general real estate knowledge. It goes into depth. Some of what it includes is getting into investments and more financial stuff that isn't covered as heavily in the general, or excuse me, in the pre-licensing course. But a big part of our curriculum for brokers is Alaska law. It's understanding the disclosures and how we represent our clients and customers, trust accounting, the recovery fund. All of those items are very specific. I mean, those are specific to Alaska. So a big part of that, and I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly, but it is a big part of our curriculum is as Alaska statute specific.
Paul?
Thank you. Brief follow-up. So those are all specific regarding licensing as a broker, associate broker, and the like. Is there a continuing education requirement as you renew your license with Department of Commerce that usually probably the two-year cycle that you complete so many hours of continuing education?
Yes, sir. All licensees are required to have a minimum of 20 hours of continuing education every 2 years prior to our license. All of our licenses expire January 31st of every even year. That education, 8 hours of that education, that continuing education, 8 hours of it is Alaska specific. And then the 12 hours is what we call elective CE. Those electives are more general. Some can be, specific to Alaska. Most of our local educators do include more Alaska-specific topics in their curriculum. But the 8 hours of designated CE, we call it designated CE, those are our required courses. Those are mandated by the commission.
Through the chair, thank you. That's good stuff, and you guys are on the industry's on the right track. And that's through regulation as adopted by the commission and approved through Lieutenant Governor, right, as far as the CE hours. It's not in statute. That's something that's done by regulation to renew your license, right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, and with that, we're going to hold the bill over and keep public testimony open and go on to another real estate item, which is the sunset bill. And House Bill 290, and presenting that bill will be Laura Steidall from my office. And
she's doing all the work in your office.
She's a hard worker, worth her weight in gold. And also has the cutest baby in Juneau, I might add.
On the record.
Officially. please state your name and affiliation for the record, and it's all yours.
All right, good afternoon. I'm Laura Steidall, staff to Chairman Olson. Before you today, excuse me, I'm a little bit under the weather, but before you today is HB 290. This legislation extends the termination date of the Real Estate Commission to June 30th, 2018. Each year, the Division of Legislative Audit reviews state boards and commissions to determine if they should be reestablished per AS 2444. The Division of Legislative Audit reviewed the activities of the Real Estate Commission to determine whether there is a demonstrated public need for the board's continued existence and whether it has been operating in an effective manner. As you have noted in your review of the audit in the packets, it is the opinion of our auditors that the board is serving the public's interest by effectively licensing real estate brokers, associate brokers, and salespeople. As you've also noted from the audit, there were three recommendations, including having the legislature amend the real estate surety fund statutes to provide more complete, effective, and efficient consumer protection to the claimants. In 2008, legislation was passed, actually by this committee, HB 357, and placing a condition on real estate licensure for salespersons and brokers to obtain errors and omissions insurance. However, there was a clause in the statute, AS 888-172E, if the commission is unable to obtain a master's errors and omissions insurance policy to ensure licensees that meets the terms and conditions established, the requirement that a real estate licensee carry and maintain errors and omissions insurance under AS 888-172 is void during the period that the commission is unable to obtain the insurance. So since 2008, the commission has been unable to obtain that master E&O policy, which was in the audit the most critical piece that was missing from the commission. And so we will be offering a fix to this situation by repealing that section of HB 357 and then giving it a 2-year sunset date. And it will be put into the legislation that we were talking about in the last hearing, which was SB 158, which is Senate Labor and Commerce Bill, just the Senate version of the bill you just heard. The commission, the other two issues that were brought up have been resolved, which included a board member not satisfying statutory requirements prior to their appointment and increasing their licensure fee due to a deficit, which they no longer have anymore. Chris Curtis of Legislative Audit is here to speak on the audit, and Nancy Davis, the chair of the commission, is online from Sitka. In closing, the Real Estate Commission serves an important role by improving operations and industry practices by modifying and adopting regulations, and we would appreciate your support of this legislation.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Colbert.
Okay.
Followed by Representative Ledoux.
I was hoping for an easy thing, but a lot of questions there at the end. Through the chair, and you may want to defer, and I don't blame you at all. Why can the, I assume licensees cannot get E&O insurance? Is that what you're
saying? Representative Josephson, through the chair, licensees can get E&O insurance.
Okay.
However, they are not required to by statute at this point, because in statute it says that it's only required if the real estate commission has it, a master policy in place. However, the real estate commission has not been able to obtain that policy due to a variety of factors which we've hashed out in multiple meetings over the past couple of months. And the solution that we have found thus far is to repeal that section of HB 357 and put a sunset on that. So over the next 2 years, licensees will be required to get the E&O insurance to protect the consumer. And then...
And follow up, the companion to 357 is SB 158, is that what you said?
Well, 350, Representative Joseph, through the chair, 357 is the bill from 2008.
Okay.
SB 158 is the companion to 281, which was just heard.
Okay.
Got you thoroughly confused, I think.
No, I don't. 281, yeah, okay. So, follow up?
Certainly.
So what I hear you saying is that smart licensees, because they're smart, find a way to get malpractice insurance or E&O insurance. But it's not required. They do it because they're wise. But it's not required through – it's not possible through some existing policy relative to a master policy that the commission would offer?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, it's – they're able to obtain it. The people that aren't able to obtain it are those that are in a risk pool that the master's policy was supposed to cover, these people that couldn't obtain it on their own. So it's not about, I would say, not the smart licensee. I mean, more responsible would be the word I would use.
Follow up.
I'm thinking I could probably answer it, but
how does someone get into a pool that makes them high risk?
Representative
Josephson. As a realtor or licensee.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I am not certain about that. I would like to defer to probably Nancy Davis or perhaps.
I can take a shot at it. We were approached a number of years ago by our real estate board to put legislation in effect that would allow them to go into a not necessarily a pool, but a group of all the real estate agents and brokers in the state. And we did it. They came to us because they had a market that was going to do it. It was going to be a good deal for everybody, and then there was little or no follow through on it, which is why we're where we're at now. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people went out and got their own insurance, but it was never addressed on a group basis. Okay. And the clock ran, and the clock ran, and it's now 7 years later, I believe. And it was duly noted by Chris Curtis in the audits that it had never, there was not a lot of follow-through on it. We also have Lori Wang-Heyer here from the Division of Insurance that could shed some light on it, too. Would you like to join us, Lori?
Yes, sir.
Happy to talk about anything but health insurance.
Anything but Medicaid, right?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lori Wang-Heyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. I have not been involved in this as others, but I can tell you that I have worked some with CBPL in the recent months on this. And as the Mr. Chairman has said, there have been some roadblocks in this. One, I believe the statute says that it cannot be more than $300, the policy, which we looked at the filings we have for the insurance companies that are doing business in the state of Alaska, and we don't have one that is writing a premium for a policyholder less than $300. Mm-hmm. So that was one obstacle. Then we're not, when we looked at doing a pool or a master policy, we don't have any underwriting data. We don't know how many brokers would participate. We don't know if they're commercial. We don't know if they're doing residential. We don't know what the mix is. We don't know where they're writing. We don't know if they've had any claims presented against them. So we're now laying the foundation to gather that, to see what there would be for a master policy or perhaps a pool. But that had not been done, and or had not been presented before to look at it at that aspect. There had been insurance as a whole is not purchased, you know, off the shelf. And so when you look at it in procurement to just put out a bid, we had not received responders. And so we had looked had to look at it as okay. I mean, we had looked at it to putting out a bid to just say, did anybody would, as a regular RFP, would anybody be interested? And these are the criteria where there weren't enough criteria to have anybody bid on it. So then we had to go back to the drawing board. And I want to correct myself that the $300 is in regulation and not statute. But so we are just we've had some roadblocks, and so now we are kind of back to the drawing board. But we have met with. Laura, certainly, and in Commerce, and with the commission, and we are working going forward on it kind of as a team, working looking at how insurance works, and then also at what the commission needs to resolve the situation.
Representative Colbert.
I don't have any questions of staff or the insurance director, but I can see why you're not going to get a pool for E&O. An E&O carrier wants to look specifically at the risk of each party and their ability to perform their job, you know, their profession, and how many lawsuits were against a specific firm. You have to fill out reams and reams of background data on your expertise, and you have to have a business history. So it would, they wouldn't want to insure a new broker because they had no business history. So we've kind of created this thing that really is probably impossible to meet, right?
Actually, I can still remember what happened. The brokers came to me with a, or the real estate industry came to me with a model bill that was, in effect, outside, and that's what they wanted. And so it was basically a national program. I learned off of that on what happened on that. I've only done two model laws now that haven't been either sponsored by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners or the National Conference of Insurance Legislators. Both of those groups have model bills that I feel comfortable with, but I've been not burned. I've had unique experiences with two, and this was one for a lot of the reasons that you brought up.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the $300 was the other reason. $300 was probably adequate outside, but it certainly wasn't up here, and I think that's and again, it wasn't. They were given a product that they thought would work up here, and it didn't. And I think the market changed right after that as well.
Well,
but
yeah.
$300 for per licensee would have been a really good deal.
Yeah, I would prefer to work on a from a disclosure standpoint. You know, somehow that the consumer is black and white on their real estate contract. I carry errors and omissions, or I don't, and leave it up to individual brokers because the individual broker needs to make the application. It's very expensive. And so a small broker may or may not be profitable with the amount of overhead it would cost them. It may be $10,000. It's going to depend on your business experience and then the deductible on that E&O policy. You know, if I had a claim on my E&O policy and it was small, you know, less than $50,000, I would pay it out of pocket because I'd never get insurance again. And if the state regulated my industry and said we had to do it, I think there'd be a lot of pushback. And generally, it's the customer in some businesses that require that. But I'm hesitant to legislate because real estate is more of a small business. We might be better off to just have very clear disclosure requirements and look at, unless we can produce a case history where we have had a lot of unsettled claims and the need to have error. I'm very reluctant to require that from the state top down to carry that because of it's like a performance bond. Before 9/11 and before the crash of the economy in 2008, the contractor could pretty easily get a performance bond, payment performance bond. They're very difficult to get now. Errors and omissions is similar to a payment performance bond. And you're going to need to go to one of the bigger national firms to get one. So I think we need to kind of rethink this process that, you know, we're going to sunset and make you come back and do it and maybe bring some people in that are out there in the business community.
You want to address that, Laura? Clear up the smoke?
Representative Culver, through the chair, we, first of all, the real estate industry, who we met with, several professionals, have indicated that any good broker or licensee is already carrying E&O insurance. It is this small pool of people that is not carrying it, and because their premiums would be too high or for whatever the reason, and it is the master policy that is going to protect the consumer as well as allow them to operate in the state. And while I can see where you're coming from with regulating it, I do believe that it is the Real Estate Commission's authority to protect the consumer, and this is one of the functions that the policy does for the consumer.
Representative Jones?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I guess what I'm wondering is, looking at Ms. Curtis's audit, recommendation number 2 says there's 36 of 235 investigations open. And then coming back to the issue that we've been discussing, are people failing to get E&O because they've had one of these complaints filed against them, in effect, that they've made some mistake, as can happen? Or can they simply not afford the premium? And if the answer is the latter, what is the premium? I mean, I agree with what I think Representative Culver is saying. The purchaser-seller, they're not going to ask generally, are you insured? They got other things on their mind. And I want people fully insured. And we need to deal with this problem. It's a serious problem.
Representative Josephson, through the chair. Unfortunately, one of the things we encountered with the Real Estate Commission was the unavailability of data as to which brokers and which real estate salespeople actually had insurance or not. We never received any of that data, and I don't believe it is on record at this point.
Now, I might add, we're not singling out the real estate industry. There are a number of other professional trades where people don't carry E&O or malpractice because of the price. I know doctors that don't. I know attorneys that don't. I know architects and engineers that have all their assets in their spouse's name. So when they get sued, or if they get sued, that they have a shield that probably won't hold up too well. But it's not limited to the real estate. But it came to our attention 8 years ago, and it's still there. And we're working with the people that we can, and they've got 2 years to work their way through it or come back and ask for something else. But Representative Culver, followed by Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, well, how does the workers' comp risk pool work? I mean, is it possible to do something like that, that you don't qualify, then you get into the workers' comp assigned risk pool?
That sounds like one for the director of the Division of Insurance.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, the assigned risk pool is, we put that out for bid every 4 years. It's ran through the National Council on Compensation Insurance for us, and the applications are submitted to the NCCI, the National Council, and then the participating insurers, which bid for the business, they have to be working, selling insurance, workers' compensation insurance in the state of Alaska, and then they are assigned basically a percentage of the business. We rate their proposals that they submit to the state, and then they are assigned a percentage of the business 40%, 50%, whatever it takes to do 100% of the assigned risk pool, so to speak.
But you really couldn't.
Paul?
Yeah, you really couldn't do a errors and omissions coverage in that regard, because errors and omissions is more like a bank loan. It's based on professional expertise, experience, credit, versus a straight occupational percentage. Carpenters pay this amount of workers' comp insurance, you know.
Through the chair. It's
concrete workers, another one. Iron workers, another one, right?
Through the chair, it's based on a number of underwriting factors that are related to that individual and his or her business of what they're doing, particular their experience in that line.
Yeah.
And that's the data we don't have.
Representative Ledoux.
So I guess what I don't understand, as it's been pointed out, we've got doctors without insurance. We've got lawyers without insurance. I'm sure we have dentists without insurance. It does actually seem that we're focusing on the realtors. And I mean, a doctor without insurance or a lawyer without insurance could probably do a significant amount more damage than a realtor without insurance. So, I mean, why are we focusing on the realtors here?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, HB 357, there was two parts to it. There was the Realty Recovery Fund, which was turned into the Realty Surety Fund. And the Realty Recovery Fund was, as I, if I'm recalling correctly, if you had a complaint or grievance against a realtor, you went in front of the commission. And I believe you could get up to $15,000 from the fund if there was an issue. Now you have to have a judgment given to them by the court system to recover any money from the fund. So that shifted responsibility from the commission into the court system. And then the other piece of it was, so if you're not going to, if you're going to require the consumer to go through the court system, then the realtor now must get E&O insurance.
So why do we do that? I mean, why didn't we just leave it, you know, what was broken?
I'd have to take that one. It's in statute. We put it in statute because they wanted it.
We put it in statute.
But it didn't work.
But, I mean, follow up? So if it doesn't work, why don't we just go back to the way it was? Like we just
they're taking one more shot at it. Oh. And it's been extremely complicated, but nothing's been done. It's obviously not working. It, you know, went on the books in 2008, I believe.
Okay.
And all we got is we're trying this, we're trying that. My personal feeling is that they probably weren't trying real hard because they didn't have to. And they got rid of the fund. A lot of them didn't like the fund because it would, you know, they felt if somebody was getting paid that possibly they shouldn't have. And it was, I believe they ran out of money on a regular basis. Which didn't help as well. So, I mean, there were a lot of factors involved in what they were doing. They saw a national program that worked in 48 or 49 other states. What can I say? It's been a problem. It's been a thorn for them. It's been probably a thorn for some consumers. Not many, or we would have heard a lot more, or there would have been a trail. But it's been... It looks like something maybe judiciary should handle.
Yeah, I think so.
And can I ask another discreet question?
Certainly.
So this is our second real estate bill today. Would legislative audit normally look at things like educational requirements and requirements for how long somebody is supposed to be working in a profession before they can advance to another aspect of the profession? Is that something that legislative audit would look at?
If nobody has any more questions for Lori, I'll bring Chris back up. Chris Curtis, welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And
Good afternoon. Chris Curtis with Legislative Audit. Representative Ledoux through the chair. When Legislative Audit does a sunset review, we are required to follow 11 criteria that we evaluate a commission against when we do the review. And these are set out as part of the sunset legislative oversight process. Mm-hmm. So we do not look at an occupation to see, in that regard, do they have enough education. What we look at is, what is the commission doing to protect the public's interest? Are they active in regulating their industry? Are they responding to needs of their licensees and the public? And that type of process, which we did in this review. Specific to whether the licensees and brokers have enough education, we didn't go and compare their education to national standards, which is what I hear being used as criteria to bump up the hours. In regards to this audit, we did conclude, I want to put that on the record, that we did conclude that the Real Estate Commission is serving the public's interest generally in regulating their profession. We don't recommend terminating the commission. We do recommend extending the commission. We recommended a 6-year extension. But then we qualified that and said, but if the commission cannot address its statutory responsibility to obtain E&O insurance, then we recommend a shorter extension of 4 years if they can't demonstrate that ability by January. We did the audit in July of 2015. Now, this E&O requirement went in place in 2008, and it was effective in 2010, so they were given some time to move it forward. The Division of Insurance did not establish the terms of the insurance until, I believe, December of 2011. Regulations were not put in place, made effective until October of 2014. So quite an extensive lag in addressing it. When we got there in July of 2015 and looked at this, what were the causes? What was the reason for the time lag? We got a lot of things such as it was very complex. There was involved Department of Law quite extensively. That slowed it down. So a lot of reasons for why they hadn't moved this statutory requirement forward. But from our opinion, they weren't good enough reasons to addressing the statutory responsibility. Some of the things I'm hearing today are of interest because they weren't brought forward when we did the audit in July of 2015. I don't know if they quite had their feet under them to figure out why things hadn't been moving forward, just that they hadn't been moving forward.
Paula?
So I was just trying to figure out whether I should be reading anything into the fact that legislative audit hadn't recommended an increase of educational requirements or an increase of the amount of time that somebody had to serve as a licensee before they became a broker. That was all I was trying to figure out, and it sounds like you're saying no.
Representative Dew through the chair.
And that's why I brought her up on the other bill. She was here for this bill.
Representative Terrellson, should I go forward with the sure. presentation on the audit? Okay.
Yep.
There's some background information in the audit on page 5 that kind of sets the stage to help really understand. Laura mentioned that with the bill in 2008, they really changed a consumer protection that was in place at that point. Now, our sunset audits in the past have been critical of this fund that's in place to help protect the consumers. Consumers could come forward with a complaint. The commission would hear them, they would take evidence, issue subpoenas, that type of thing. They would rule on the case and award up to $15,000. We were critical of this. We felt they could do even more. We thought $15,000 wasn't high enough, given the dollar values of the damage that folks would realize. So in 2007, when we did the audit, we were critical and we recommended improving the surety fund. 2008, they actually made it harder to get a claim out of the recovery fund, now that it was named. And so they had consumers have to go through the court system, which is costly. The average person may not have the resources to go through. So, but they did that, but they also required insurance to help protect the public. So definitely in the public's interest. So when we came through and reviewed the commission, one of the things we look for is the commission serving the public's interest. And certainly in this regard, they have failed to serve the public's interest. And we've talked at length about that. But the audit makes two recommendations, one about the surety fund, one about the errors and omissions, but secondly, we found that the investigations conducted by the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing were not being done in a timely manner. We looked at 36 of the 235 cases that were active during our audit period. Of the 36 cases, 29 had significant periods of inactivity. Those periods ranged from 124 days when nothing happened on a case to over 1,600 days, 4.5 years. Of the 29 cases, 11 were closed because of age of the matter or because the licensee's license had expired. So reasons, not necessarily solid reasons for closing a case. So there are two recommendations, one on the errors and omissions to work at procuring that, and secondly, for the division to the chief investigator to work at improving the timeliness of the investigations. So based on those two, again, we recommended a shorter extension than the maximum allowed in statute and really asked the commission to come during this process to demonstrate they were able to address the errors and omissions.
And that's why the 2 year sunset probably makes a little more sense now. Any questions for Chris?
Just real fast, if I may.
Representative Jones.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Curtis, the $15,000 recovery fund, formerly the surety fund, you said, what is the source of those dollars? Is there...
Representative Josephson, through the chair, on page 15 is a little of accounting of this fund.
Okay.
It's a fee paid by licensees. And given that there's not much claims going out, the fee has dropped from $125 per licensee to $30 per licensee. And there's some requirements on how the fee is set. There need to keep a balance in the fund of a certain level. So they set those fees, I think, biannually. You can see there that there were no claims paid out in FY11 or FY12. So consumers are really not going through the fund in getting satisfaction that way. There were some in FY13 and there were some in FY14.
Thanks, Chris. We do have Errol Champion from the Alaska Association of Realtors here for questions. Come on up, Errol.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Oh, certainly.
Like the bumper sticker? We don't care how they do it outside. That's how I feel.
I'll tell you what, when I heard it, it sounded real good, just like it did to the realtors. And I'm somewhat jaundiced on pitches like that, but it did sound good. I'll take my share of the blame for it.
Good afternoon. My name is Errol Champion. I'm a broker here in Juneau, career-wise, but I'm also chair of the Issues Committee for the State Alaska Association of Realtors. I've been before you many times over the past years. I might be of more value if I answer your questions than if I try and ad lib, so here I am.
Representative Culver.
Do you think we need to require small brokers to have, well, I guess you can't speak for the association, but just give me your thoughts on how difficult it is for small brokers to get E&O insurance, new brokers, small brokers.
Or licensing.
The broker carries it, not the agents, right? Yeah.
Representative Gulliver, through the chair, I'm not an insurance broker. We maintain coverage in our office. I don't want to lengthen the testimony out, but I can sense that it might be beneficial if we described actually how a brokerage works. All of your licensees are independent contractors. It's not like having a regular boss subordinate, so you have operating policies, and each of these independent contractors conduct their real estate, and they start off as a licensee, and as you heard in the previous testimony or the previous bill's testimony, They may elect to stay a licensee, or they may elect at some point in time to advance themselves into an associate broker and then a broker. Now, Alaska law will only allow one broker in an office. There cannot be multiple. So you would become an associate broker, and then when the broker did something else, that person could move forward if he wants to take on the liabilities and the risk. But it's somewhat difficult because of the independent contractor status that you really should have errors and omissions insurance, because you don't have periodic reviews, you don't have performance reviews. The right to terminate someone's employment is really stipulated by the Real Estate Commission, and that simply sends his license back to the Real Estate Commission. So it's an entirely different arrangement. I think the ones that I know that do not is simply an economic factor. They work alone. They're generally in small communities like Craig or out in Bethel, and so that it's difficult to qualify for it. But your large brokerage houses, I don't think there's very many that don't have E&O insurance.
Representative Josephson? No. Thanks a lot, Errol.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
It would be my intent, if the committee is willing, to move the bill out, because it has to go to finance, and with the two-year sunset, if it's the committee's wishes.
And we'll deal with the E&O issue when?
It'll be dealt with when the next bill comes over.
Oh, that's right.
Well, there's going to be a consensual
one on the
melding.
CE and other.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, just I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 290-29-LS1345/W from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any opposition? Seeing none, the sunset moves out to the next committee, and as soon as everybody signs, they can leave.